Hey, welcome to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. Glad to have you with us today. And we're here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. And we'd appreciate it if you tell a friend, have them tune in. And remember, our shows are archived on our homepage here. So if you miss all or part of this or any of the other shows we've had, you can go to them and listen to them at your leisure. Got two excellent guests this morning, Katie Maddox and Greg Stanford. They were with the Federal Managers Association, and as the name would imply, they represent federal managers in the federal government. Greg, what's the GS level pretty much in the federal managers?
Well, it differs from agency and department, but generally anywhere from GS-9 up to GS-15, and then we also have some senior executives who are our members, but generally GS-12 to 15.
Okay, interesting. And Katie, there's so much going on now. I'm so glad to have you guys here because I can't even keep track of the congressional schedule. The House is going out tomorrow, is that correct?
That's correct. And then the Senate is going to be in next week. And hopefully they'll get some stuff done before the summer recess.
Yeah. Well, you know, looking at what the things Congress is talking about doing to federal workers, feds maybe are almost better off if they're out of town, right?
when they're not in town, you know, we're not so much on the chopping block. But we're going to have to wait and see what, you know, they do get done while they are in town, and hopefully we don't get hit too bad.
Okay, well, good news, which is short supply, is the federal pay raise is at least on target?
Yes, it is. So far, it hasn't been brought up by Congress, and, you know, it's the old saying, no news is good news.
Yeah.
So they're on target for a 1.3% pay raise. I know it's not much, but I think after nothing for 3 years, you know, I think a lot of people, you know, are happy to get something, but we're still working to, you know, get more.
And I want to ask both of you, I know they're trying to expand the locality pay areas to add some new cities to this. With a raise that size of 1.3%, does locality pay make much difference, if any?
It would depend. I know, like, in some areas, it really depends on where the locality is. I know we've discussed with Senator Heitkamp an increase in locality pay there, and basically it would just make it a locality pay increase would just make it more competitive with the private sector. And I know that's always on the minds of, you know, FMA and other advocacy groups, is how do you make sure that you are able to attract people to the federal workforce? And by making, you know, more competitive salaries, that's, you know, a step in the right direction.
I mean, correct me if I'm wrong here, but it seems like back in the day when the raises were bigger than they are now, 3%, 4%, 5%, they would, and again, I may be wrong, but the president or his agent would designate X amount as the pay raise for everybody, and then over there, the amount over and above that could be applied to locality pay, and it might vary from D.C. to Houston to San Francisco. Is that right?
That, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that was kind of the usual order. And, you know, you saw at the earlier this summer, there were increases to a variety of localities.
Yeah.
Some that come to mind are St. Louis and Kansas City, Albuquerque, the Las Vegas area, that those areas did
were
get
added
a bump in mm-hmm. locality pay. But you're exactly right. And our national president, Patricia Niehaus, is located in the near the Bay Area. And, you know, the cost of living in
sure.
the San Francisco area is just enormous.
Yeah, Lauren Larson, our producer, was out in Silicon Valley a couple of weeks ago, and she was checking out rents and said that she returned to Washington quickly. and before I leave the pay thing, when the locality pay started out and they earmark X amount for everybody, the Russ, the rest of U.S., and then the locality pay cities, Washington, Houston, San Francisco, places like that, they got considerably more. And now you have cities like Houston, San Francisco, San Jose, Los Angeles. Many cities are above the pay scale for Washington. But it looks like that spread can't continue if the raises continue to be small. You know what I mean? The differentials are going to go away over time.
You know, I haven't heard about that, and
I'm just doing the math, which is not my strong suit. But if it's a 1.3% raise, and they earmark a small amount to it, you know, back in the day, I remember 1 year Buffalo, New York, got this huge raise because they had been added to the locality pay area, and it was deemed they were behind everybody in the Buffalo area in the private sector. But So we'll just have to wait and see what's what it's going to work out to be. But there are these new cities added to the locality pay now.
That's correct. That's correct.
The other good news, Greg, you were talking about Wounded Warriors Act.
Yeah, and that's we're delighted that last night the Senate passed by unanimous consent S-242. It's a bill sponsored by John Tester, a Democrat from Montana, and Jerry Moran. So it's a Republican.
Bipartisan.
So bipartisan, and it's also bicameral. There's legislation that Representative Lynch and Farenthold have introduced in the House, but the Senate version passed by unanimous consent last night. It's an idea that was originated by an FMA member at Marine Corps Air Station Cherry Point in North Carolina, and she brought it to us, and we thought it was a great idea and developed it and worked with staff, again, with Mr. Lynch and Mr. Farenthold, and then on the Senate side with Mr. Tester and Mr. Moran. And delighted that it both the House and the Senate versions have passed their respective committees by unanimous consent. That was earlier this year, end of January and the first part of March.
So what's it going to do? What will it do?
It would provide additional sick leave for disabled veterans who have a service-connected disability rating of 30% or greater. You know, when you enter the federal workforce, you start with zero sick leave, and this would provide an extra bump for those who have to go in order to maintain their service-connected disability rating. They have to go and get treatments. And so this would provide a little, just a little bump for them. And this, it's extra time. It'd be 104 hours for that would be given to a newly hired disabled veteran. And it's time that they would have to use for in connection with their service-connected disability, so that if their child gets the flu and they have to stay home, or if they have to go to a dentist appointment, they have to use accrued sick leave like everyone else. And also the time does not roll over to the second year, so it's a use it or lose it provision. So if they didn't actually need this extra bump, then they don't. You know, that's not an expense.
And an FMA member from Cherry Point suggested this or proposed it.
That's correct. Yeah. Sue Thatch from Marine Corps Air Station. Yeah.
Be interesting to see who votes against this.
Well, so far, no one, so that's great.
Yeah.
But Sue saw the need because she had some employees who were disabled vets. And I'm not sure how familiar you are with the Cherry Point area. But
I do know it a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, but her employees were taking, you know, several hours, you know, just to get out to their VA appointments. And I believe used 30 hours within the first 3 months of the year. So by the time the year would been up, if, you know, he kept using it at that rate, he would have gone over the amount of sick leave he could have actually earned. So we're just hoping that this will provide some safety net, you know.
Yeah, that's important for a lot of reasons. I think many people outside of government don't realize how good an employer Uncle Sam is when it comes to veterans. You know, the VA, defense, but amazing number of veterans, a high percentage, and a high percentage of those are disabled vets. Mm-hmm. So this could be a bellwether for the private sector, too, to get them in line and maybe do a little bit more for their disabled vets who are using the sick leave strictly for treatment and diagnosis and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. So we're delighted that it's made the progress that it has.
Yeah.
Look forward to getting it over the finish line.
What's the situation with the VA now? They're talking about the Veterans Department of Veterans Affairs, the VA for old days. They're talking about it becoming an at-will employer. What does that mean?
So the concern is stripping away due process. You know, right now, employees have a minimum of a 30-day notice from the day that there's a proposal to remove or demote, and that gives the agency time to prepare their case. It also gives the employee due process to defend themselves. You know, we have a civil service, and there have been civil service reforms since the 1800s to get away from some kind of a spoils system, some kind of making it a political thing, using federal employees as political pawns. And so truncating the time that an employee has to defend themselves appropriately, we just think is inappropriate, and have been advocating against. You know, the last summer, the Congress pushed through legislation affecting senior executives at the VA, and now they are expanding that with legislation that would basically expand that and get on that slippery slope of turning civil servants into at-will employees, and expanding that to everybody at the VA, and really just harming recruitment and retention.
Well, was there also a proposal to increase the probation period in the government or in the VA?
There are several proposals right now. There's actually there is a proposal that is a provision that would increase the probationary period at VA. There's a provision in the NDAA right now, and there's also been legislation introduced that would apply to every worker under Title V.
I wanted to ask you about that probation period, but we need to take a short break. Be right back here on federalnewsradio.com. Mike Causey here. Welcome back to Your Turn. I'm talking with Katie Maddox and Greg Stanford from the Federal Managers Association. And before the break, we were talking about the Department of Veterans Affairs, the VA, and there's legislation to do a number of things to it, and one of them would make it easier to fire people and make it quicker to fire people. And this, of course, is in reaction to the scandal at the VA centers in Phoenix and some other places where some employees have admitted to cooking the books, fixing the records to make it appear that they were giving service to veterans in a timely manner when in fact they weren't, some cases. But it's typical political, many would say, overreaction. And this, they're going to take the second largest agency in government, change the probation period, extend it so that people could be fired at will or without cause, just for whatever reason. And I think a lot of people don't understand, like critics of the government complain, and they're right, that the number of federal workers who are fired each year is relatively small compared to the size of government. And they say this is proof in and of itself that the government, you can't fire a government employee. The pro-civil service types counter that the probation period is when you weed out so many people, and that many, many, many people come into government and disappear and don't get full-time jobs based on this probation period. And if you extended it, that would extend their time of peril. But they're talking about almost doubling it, are they not?
Yesterday we reached out to members of the House about a bill that was recently introduced by Ken Buck of Colorado. And he's calling for an extension of the probationary period for 2 years after the initial training period is over. And so I would like to point out that during that probationary time, you know, it's more easy to get rid of bad actors. And, you know, we're not saying that there aren't bad actors in federal employment. However, there are already measures that people can take, you know, to discuss poor performers, correct actions. However, we're nervous about how far issues like this are going. Like Greg said, in the VA bill, just getting away with due process is not the way to go about this.
Yeah, okay, and it's typical overreaction. They're also talking in Congress now. Many Republicans in the House are angry over this, the Lois Lerner affair, you know, giving conservative groups, Tea Party groups, a hard time when they were trying to get tax exempt status. And there's some evidence that happened. One of the questions is, how high did it go and where did the orders come from? The usual Washington thing, what did you know and when did you know it? But a lot of people believe that the Congress now is punishing the IRS for this and other real and imagined sins by cutting the budget. That in turn cuts service, particularly because IRS has major new duties under the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare now. So that's added to their work. The number of people filing every year increases. The number of people asking for help increases. And the primary job of the Internal Revenue Service is to collect taxes, collect money. And it's not doing it as well as it did last year, and it did it less well in the year before that. And now there's this call in Congress again to privatize the operations and turn it over to private debt collectors who would get a percentage of the take using data supplied to them by the IRS. How's that going?
Well, I haven't heard so much about the privatization side, but you know, to comment on what you were talking about earlier about, you know, the thought process of, you know, there are perceived problems at the IRS, so Congress limits the budget, like you said, every appropriation cycle, and it's almost a you get what you pay for kind of a thing. Of, you know, if you're not going to give the men and women of the IRS the resources they need to do the jobs, then of course you're going to see a decline in customer service, and you're going to have problems. And the big problem that we see is the IRS is is one of the primary agencies that actually brings in revenue to the federal government, and then you're also going to see if the IRS is understaffed or, you know, and doesn't have the resources that they need, you're going to see delays in getting your IRS return. And I know that people like the IRS
people
then,
being put on hold when they're calling in for taxpayer help. Well, yeah, a couple of members of Congress have suggested this, and it's as if they didn't realize that this has been tried at least twice before in recent memory. They turned it over to private debt collectors. They used data supplied to them by the IRS, but they used very different methods. They called them junkyard dogs, and they'd call people at night and midnight. They'd harass them at work, and it became a national scandal. And then the IRS got in trouble with Congress for that, a problem that Congress had itself created, and they may be heading that way again.
I think that's what we're seeing. And, we, you know, our message to Congress is to fund the IRS appropriately, make sure that the men and women in the workforce have the resources and the tools that they need to provide the services. They do an excellent job, by and large. And as Katie said, there are bad apples, but you mm-hmm. see bad apples in every walk of life, in any population, be it the private sector or the public sector. And, you know, you address those, but, you know, don't harm the men and women, and therefore the entire, you know, American citizenry by overreacting to perceived scandals.
During the shutdown last year, I got a couple of emails from IRS employees, agents, or collection agents, or whatnot, and they were talking about the fact that while they were off, how much money the government was losing, mm-hmm. their salaries notwithstanding, because of how much they bring in. And it was thousands of dollars a day in some cases, mm-hmm. just waiting to be collected.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And that's the problem that we see. You know, that was a huge problem with sequestration. That's a huge problem with the shutdown, of that loss of productivity. And you can't get back that time. And it's not just, you know, like you said, it's not just the salaries and the huge impact that is on the employees themselves and their families, but we're talking about the communities that they live and work in, and that loss of productivity of whatever the services they're providing to the American public. You're not going to get that, and you're not going to be able to get that time back, and that's irreplaceable.
Yeah, that demand for services, that doesn't go away just because there's a shutdown. That's actually usually increased.
Yeah.
And so all the shutdown did was cause more problems, cause the economy. It didn't do anything good.
It amazes me. The shutdown was one thing. Sequestration was another. But the sequestration was a poison pill that nobody claims they wanted, and they let it happen. And then they're sort of blaming the system. But this came right out of the politics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they've done. And everybody says that. Everybody to this day still says it's a bad thing, and, you know, we need to do away with it. And it's still the law of the land, and it's, you know, still what they're basing budgets on, and it's going to be tough unless there's some kind of, you know, grand compromise like Murray Ryan.
Ask you about the data hack, and we're still fallout from that, and if we do this show 10 years from now, we may still be talking about what's happening as a result of this. The government is now saying it won't name which country they believe did it, although previously they had said China. The intelligence people say that it's at the moment, it's not necessarily your normal hack issue, in that somebody is going to set up a bank account in your name or open a credit card, a bogus credit card in your name. They're worried more about the information. They know who you are. They know what agency you work for. They know where you work. They know your mother's maiden name. That's potential for mischief in a variety of ways, including recruitment, blackmail, and that sort of thing. But as far as the data breach itself, are you hearing from members? Are they concerned about this?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think we get an email, phone call at least once a day, if not more. And I think what's really concerning is the wide variety of customer service that our members are getting.
Yeah.
We either hear that our members have been on hold for 2 hours or it was easy. And, you know, I'm glad that who reached out to CSID and got everything taken care of like immediately. I'm glad that, you know, worked out for them. But what about the person who's on hold for 2 hours? And there's doesn't really seem to be much of a middle ground. And they're concerned about what information is out there. Is identity theft protection actually going to help them? You know, if it's only if they're only going to be protected, you know, for 18 months, 10 years, well, what happens after that time is up? I mean, it's obviously all over the press of how long protections last. You know, they can just sit on that information and wait until, you know, they can use it. Your social security number isn't going to change. Your mother's maiden name isn't going to change. That information is always going to be relevant.
Somebody explained it to me, somebody within the security business, and he said this, the quote, protection that you're getting, regardless of which company, it's sort of like, somebody's breaking into your house, they will hear the glass tinkling in the window and they will say, hey, I think somebody's breaking into your house, but they don't make house calls. They don't, there's no follow-up, and it's up to you then to defend yourself. Is that your sense of it?
That is my sense as well. I mean, and I think I've seen a couple, you know, of comments on, you know, what exactly am I getting out of identity theft protection? Obviously it's already been stolen. Like, you're just kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop.
Hold that thought. Take a short break here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Your Turn. I'm Mike Causey. I'm talking with Katie Maddox and Greg Sanford from the Federal Managers Association. We've been doing sort of a legislative roundup. And also, if you look on our homepage at Federal News Radio today, Mike O'Connell of our staff has a good rundown as to where bills are going. Katie and Greg, during the break, we were talking about we're over halfway through the year now, the calendar year and the political year. Did you say there are only 12 working days left in this first session of Congress?
Before the end of the fiscal year.
Before the end of the fiscal year, which is October 1. Yep. 12 working days between now and October 1. I want a job like that. well, now, I believe you said the House has passed 6 appropriations bills. The Senate has passed none.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
This is kind of par for the course. It doesn't matter whether Harry Reid is in charge of the Senate or Mitch McConnell. It doesn't matter. It's not a Democratic or Republican thing. It just seems as if the Congress now has just given up on the idea of passing appropriations bills, that we're living in an era that a continuing resolution is the new normal.
That's probably one of the saddest things I've heard. But yeah, unfortunately, we just keep getting tied down with using CRs instead of going through the appropriate process through appropriations. And I know our members are incredibly frustrated by it because instead of being able to plan out, you know, what they need to do, what programs and what projects they need to accomplish, instead they have to think only in short terms. And that's not a good way, you know, to accumulate savings. That's not a good way to, you know, financially plan out an agency and what they need to do.
What about the possibility of the feared word shutdown? Is that, I mean, I've heard some people say that's not likely to happen because we're so close to 2016, which is an election year. What do you think?
I think since the shutdown in 2013, you know, it's always been, you know, a good threat.
Yeah.
You know, we've seen what it can cause. We see the damages. And it's kind of like, you know, if you don't do things my way, you know, I'm just going to say the word shutdown, but hopefully it won't come to that.
Well, it seems to me that the last few, and going back to the Clinton era, Clinton versus Newt Gingrich, that whoever causes the shutdown, and, you know, you can argue that the president didn't budge or the House didn't do this, but they were both doing what they're constitutionally allowed to do, and that is, they don't like this, they don't like that. But it seems to me that the Republicans usually lose the public relations war in these shutdowns. Is that your sense?
I think a lot of people lost the public relations war during the last shutdown. You know, there was just a lot of finger wagging and, you know, calling each other out. And I think the public got just really frustrated with the fact that it was more of a blame game and not, you know, coming to a solution. I think a lot of people suffered from that.
Well, it's the irony too. You had you had furloughs, which is one totally separate issue, based on sequestration, and then you had the shutdown based on politics and failure to do their duty. In the case of the sequestration furloughs, people lost up to 20% pay per week if they were furloughed 1 or 2 days a week, or 1 or 2 days per pay period. So they didn't get paid, and that money's gone forever. And FEA, the Federal Employees Education Assistance Fund, literally ran out of money right away because people were living paycheck to paycheck, and they needed short-term interest-free loans just to pay the bills and get it done. The shutdown is the kind of thing, if you propose this for a Hollywood script, I think it would probably be rejected as being ridiculous. Because you shut down something, you force some people to stay home, you force other people to come into work, the so-called essentials, yeah, as opposed to non-essentials, yeah, with the title. And then in the end, you pay everybody for it. How does that work?
Again, it's one of those things where, you know, if the shutdown didn't happen, they would have gone into work. That was beyond the control of federal employees. And we were very grateful that some members of Congress recognized that the shutdown was not federal employees' fault. They would have gladly gone into work instead of being concerned of whether or not their mortgage was going to get paid. And
that's where teleworking kicked in, too, because a lot of people who normally would have been on vacation, if you will, suddenly had to work.
They weren't allowed to telework.
Yeah, okay. They were not. Okay.
They were not. I know. You could not use any, you know, government equipment, anything like that. I know a lot of our executive board members were like, I've never worked a 40-hour, you know, mm-hmm, week in my life. I'm always 60 to 80. Mm-hmm. And you're telling me that I can only work 32 hours and I cannot check my email?
Yeah, and the answer is yes. That's what they're
saying. Yeah, and I think a lot of people found that incredibly frustrating and, you know, only can hope that it doesn't happen again.
Got a couple of minutes here. I wanted to ask you about the G Fund. The G Fund in the federal, the 401k plan, the Thrift Savings Plan, it's the Treasury Securities Fund. It's available only to people in the Thrift Savings Plan itself and the Social Security Trust Fund. It's the Rock of Gibraltar. It's guaranteed by the government. 90% of the people who are investing in the Thrift Savings Plan have something in it, and I think over 50% have almost all everything in it. So it's a big deal. It's not necessarily a good financial move to do that, but that's another issue. But it is a safe harbor, the safest. And they're talking about cutting the interest rates? I don't understand.
Yeah, there has been a proposal that's been floated twice this year. We've seen it. It was included in part of the House Republican, or the House budget proposal, and then and that was not part of the final budget resolution, but then the idea popped up again as a pay for funding extension of the highway bill, and, you know, something that has absolutely nothing to do with these folks. And as you said, it is the Rock of Gibraltar. It's the safe place. Even though it like you said, it doesn't keep up with inflation, and but at least that money is then safe. And the proposal, the projected savings that they've been talking about are that cutting the rate of return to, I think it's 0.02%, would just make the fund worthless. And so I don't know a single federal employee or uniformed servicemen who would keep their money in something that is virtually worthless, and that's the Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board, who manages the TSP. That's their words of making the G Fund virtually worthless, because you'd see everybody moving their money out of the G Fund into something like the L Fund,
which is more volatile.
Exactly. And then TSP also itself has more than $21 billion of the L Funds in the G Fund.
Yeah.
And the FRTIB has already said that they would take that $21 billion and immediately move that around to balance the portfolio, because it makes no sense to have anything in the G Fund if you make it virtually worthless. So we were proud. FMA, our national president, Patricia Niehaus, sent a letter to every member of the U.S. Senate opposing the change and cutting the rate of return to the G Fund. We also signed on to a couple of coalition letters opposing that, and we were happy that it was removed as a pay for.
Looking good. Okay. Listen, thank you. Thank you, Greg. Thank you, Katie, for being with us. We'll talk to you soon. We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, we'll talk with Jill Arturo from the Federal Times. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. We had a good chat with Greg Stanford and Katie Maddox from Federal Managers Association, and they're so interested in our next guest that they're sitting here in the studio enthralled and ready to hear from Jill Arturo. She's the new editor of Federal Times. Jill, are you with us?
I'm here.
Hey, thank
I'm
you.
Here.
I understand you've been a traveling woman.
I have been traveling, yes. I was at the NCMA conference. We focused on innovation. I was on a panel talking about perception of federal contracting and contractors, so it was a great show.
Was there talk about the breach, the data breach down there?
There was talk about the multiple data breaches.
And it was
discussed in terms of, you know, whether or not responsibility should be laid upon contractors versus government versus both, whether that aspect is even handled fairly. That was one topic that came up, because a lot of the conference really focused on the collaboration between government and contractors, whether there's enough of it, how it can improve, and a lot of that kind of comes down to kind of shared responsibility. So it's interesting.
Someone who used to work at Social Security, and he's now actually the president of a small company, he emailed and said the thing to do is for the Social Security Administration to issue 23 million new Social Security numbers.
Wow.
Those people who've been compromised. Have you heard of anything like that?
I haven't heard that suggested. And to be honest, the only reason I don't think that's a solution is, in a lot of ways, Social Security numbers are the least of the risk, really. You know, I mean, people can get at Social Security numbers frightfully easily, I would say. And it's a lot of the other information, perhaps in combination with the Social Security numbers, that really kind of made this a little, you know, unprecedented.
Well, the one that's always that I've been wise to for years is I don't use my mother's maiden name. I've never used it in any document. Because, again, that's fairly easy to find out.
Yeah.
Facebook or, you know, genealogy.com. So there are other things. So what are you guys working on over there now?
You know, we're focusing a lot right now we have a cover story coming up that's looking actually, and it relates to the show a bit, but kind of out of the box procurement strategies that help government innovate faster and more efficiently, while also perhaps opening the door for more small companies to play. 18F over at GSA had, you know, a really interesting program that is already underway that kind of sets up these sprints where it asks companies to deliver a product. It didn't have a 100-page RFP. It instead said, you know what, here's what we want. Show us how you can do it. And they delivered an actual, what you might call a software prototype. And it's in the hands of GSA that are playing with all the options. And so the winner will, to some degree, be chosen based on what they actually brought to the table. So it's an interesting concept, and it allows you know, that's just one example, but it's a good example of how small companies that don't have these big procurement shops that can turn around 100-page bids for opportunities could potentially play in the market. And it gets government some really interesting technology faster. So we're looking a lot at that in terms of how government can take advantage of what's out there in industry and capabilities still within the confines of federal regulations.
Less red tape, it sounds almost un-American, you know.
Yeah.
You know, the Washington Post had a story the other day about employee engagement and morale, and they said it's down. They looked at the various indexes, not the Post, but the Office of Personnel Management and the Congressional Research Service, and all manner of people have looked at these things, and they said that morale is not as good this year as it was last year. Well, guess what? Last year it was worse than it had been the year before. I'm trying to think of a time, you know, without being sarcastic, when government morale was good.
Yeah, no, it's true, and I think it's a combination of challenging budgets, which creates constraints not only on programs but also on training internally, how employees can be engaged, career development. A lot of that has really, unfortunately, been limited in recent years, and a lot of the times it's blamed on budget. I think it's also a matter of government not taking the time to put these programs together because they shouldn't cost that much money. But I think that does a number on morale. And then, as we already talked about, you have situations of security breaches and so forth, people feeling like their information is not being protected. That doesn't necessarily help either.
Well, and I noticed that in this report, if you look at the 89-page Government Accountability Office report, which I actually did, you'll see that one reason that morale has declined, it's not so bad. It hasn't gone down that much in the rest of government. In fact, in some places it's gone up. But what dragged it down were responses from the Defense Department and the Department of Homeland Security. And I just wondered, you know, with defense, you know, with these sort of endless wars, it's hard to keep track of where we're fighting now, which side we're on. We don't have boots on the ground, but we have this.
Yeah.
And then in Homeland Security, constant complaints about TSA screeners, and then this IG report that showed that 90% of the breaches that the government attempted to test got through.
Yeah.
And it's like it's wearing down.
It is. It's wearing down. I think the government workforce, particularly in DOD and DHS, because they're massive to some degree, but also because of the nature of the work they do, there's an expectation that they do need to be doing more. And unfortunately, I mean, that's true in a lot of cases, but they're doing more and they're seeing less return on that from a personal standpoint in terms of benefits and that sort of thing. So, it's challenging, you know, that kind of will put a drain on any workforce.
Well, you know, I wonder about the all of the machines people have now, iPads and smartphones, and people are working more and more. It was a BBC report this week which focused on America, and it said that something like 25% of working Americans don't have any vacation, that we take less vacation than any civilized country in the world, France being the leader with 30 days leave, and that people were leaving vacation on the table. They were not using it, and they were therefore losing it.
Yeah.
And Katie Maddox mentioned during when they were here that some of their managers during the government shutdown were not allowed to use their equipment at home, their telework, and that sort of thing. Do you think that maybe the computerization is overburdening everybody, not just government?
Oh, yes. I mean, I experience it. Do you?
Well, I check my email a lot, and I do some work from home, but you know, it doesn't rule my life.
No,
but
I know, and that's good. I was just going to say, I think it goes both ways, because I do think it's created an expectation by the employer that they can reach you if they need to reach you, and unfortunately, I think there's a sense that too many things are essential, too many things are urgent. agent when really, if you step back a bit, they're not. And if you didn't have the opportunity to reach out to an employee, they wouldn't be deemed as urgent. Now, on the same point, I think the employees do the same thing. The workforce doesn't set boundaries. I think this is true perhaps even more so in government, where there is a connection to the mission, which is essential. And I think that's why many people decide to work in government, particularly Defense Department, particularly DHS. And that engagement in terms of the mission allows people to not set their own boundaries. And that can contribute to what you were talking about in terms of morale going down and people getting burnt out. And I think it's that being digitized and being available in theory, even though you really need to learn to shut it down at certain times.
Well, you know, not to be a Luddite, but a couple of years ago we had somebody on the show. He was a CEO of a company, and he said that he tried and this was back when email was king, sort of pre-texting, and he said that they initiated a no email Friday, every Friday in the office.
Wow, for the and whole if, day. Huh?
Right. And if it was, you know, if your mother's dying, that's okay. But otherwise, no emails. And people at first resisted it, then they liked it. And he said he himself, as the king of the organization, went across the hall for something. And he met a guy he had been emailing for years, and he thought the guy was based in Denver, and he was
amazing?
Literally across the hall. I mean, the human touch seems to be missing.
Well, and that's true with even more so with the instant messaging. I mean, I've worked places where the person is two seats away from you, and you're having full conversations on the computer, and it's amazing. I've also heard of rationale. I think it was a TED Talk actually of not having having a no meeting Thursday or whatnot. And as much as meetings are good, if you actually connect with another person, so often everyone's talking in circles and not accomplishing anything. So I've heard rationales for also doing that, not allowing any meetings. Conversation, real conversation is fine, but not to just fill up a calendar for the sake of filling up a calendar.
I talked to a woman executive in the government, and she said she has all the meetings that are in her office. They're stand-up meetings. She's sitting, they're standing, and she said some people think she's playing Queen Victoria, but in fact she's going for speed.
Yes.
You know, let's get this thing over with.
Yep. Absolutely. I mean, we have meetings here, editorial meetings every Monday, and we stand around a conference table for a similar reason. I don't want it to last more than about 20 minutes because then the conversation will stray away from anything productive and people start to get frustrated.
So. Yeah, I hear those seats in the fast food places are designed to be uncomfortable after 18 minutes.
Yeah, so get you nothing. Out.
Well, Jill, listen, thank you so much for being with us. Good conference, good talking to you. Hope to talk to you next week.
Absolutely.
Hope everyone has a good week out there. We see you again, we hope, next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Have a good week.